Welcome to Home Ground. I'm Brian Kahn. This is going to be an unusual program, in part because of the subject matter and our guest, but also in part because we are sitting on the Continental Divide, just over inside the Montana border, in the headquarters of the Odell Creek Drainage. It's Montana like it used to be. What do I mean when I say that? I mean there are no human beings in view other than the two of us, and this land has been used for grazing for more than 100 years. Jim Hagenbarth knows something about that because his family has lived in this area since shortly after the Civil War, and he's been a major player in the livestock industry, both sheep and cattle, as a family since 1870. Jim, many thanks for joining us on Home Ground.
Thank you, Brian.
We're going to be talking about the use of land by human beings over time and different definitions of sustainability. What's good for the land, what's good for people, and can there be compatibility between them? We're going to start talking about something specific, sheep. Jim, tell us about your family's history in the sheep business.
Brian, after our family quit mining gold, they brought in sheep in the 1870s to this Persimmonoy Valley. And from then on, they moved over towards Spencer, Idaho, and the Targhee National Forest. They had a huge outfit, ran 150,000 head of sheep, 50,000 head of cattle. And my grandfather went to the University of Notre Dame, came back, and started working with his stepdad. And they developed this range called the Targhee. In 1902, my grandfather had the Targhee surveyed and carried that survey to Teddy Roosevelt and set this beautiful landscape aside because he was concerned about how it was being overused by everyone from the 1880s through the 1920s.
That's a highly interesting story in a number of respects. Let me just pick on one thing. You said your grandfather was concerned about overuse of this landscape by multiple users. What specifically was he concerned about?
One has to understand, when the livestock industry first came out west, they homesteaded the ground, and those who owned the water controlled the resource, and permits on federal land were given for numbers and not specific areas. Consequently, the ground is grazed over and over and over again by different owners of livestock during the same season, and it resulted in huge degradation of the range resource in the West.
How was that fundamental problem dealt with? Your grandfather proposes to Roosevelt that he do something. How did it eventually play out, that overuse?
It eventually played out. There was a tremendous public outcry about the overabuse of the resource then, as there is now. And as a result, the Taylor Grazing Act in 1934 was devised, and it gave ownership to the producers out here of leases of federal and state ground into grazing units that could be managed based upon the number of AUMs, the amount of grazing could be done on a unit, rather than on the number of livestock. And once you give ownership to an individual, then they started managing these units, which were intermingled, as one unit and almost like it was their deeded ground. So huge resource remedies started to occur.
I'm hearing you say that the giving of long-term individual leases resulted in a fundamental shift in the approach of the user, the lessor, the lessee to the land. Also, obviously, the responsibility of the leasing agency, whether it's BLM or the Forest Service, at least theoretically, is to make sure that the landscape or the grazing resource is used in a non-abusive manner. How do you think that's worked out over time in terms of the theory versus practice?
This has worked out over time in theory and practice because the landowner and the lessee holder realized that he had the total responsibility of managing the resource along with his livestock under that scenario. So he got true ownership. And you have to understand that this is kind of a new deal in the old world. They use livestock very intensively. And management of the resource and responsibility thereof is huge. And they began to understand that. Those of us who accept that responsibility started to understand that we were part of the environment, just like all the other animals, and had responsibility to keep it in a good shape. So consequently, we worked hard and started to manage our livestock in ways that provided for the sustainability and mimicking Mother Nature's disturbance that originally occurred with the large ungulate herds before we got here.
In terms of your personal experience, your experience on the land managing this grazing allotment, what are we talking about? How many years?
I've been managing this grazing allotment for over 50 years.
And so where we're sitting now is a grazing allotment that you have. How big is it?
It's 21,000 acres and encompasses five different drainages.
Now, you've just outlined what, in your view, is a change in legal structure, which has led, in my words, to a seriously enhanced stewardship of the land. It happens you and I know each other for about 20 years, and I know you're an extremely thoughtful, principled guy in trying to provide management of your livestock in a way that you feel works and is sustainable for more broad goals, including health of the ecosystem, to pick a word. At the same time, let me throw out a couple of facts that argue in a different direction. One, I can't quote the statistics, but recently I looked at a Bureau of Land Management evaluation of their leases, and the number of leases in poor and mediocre condition was very surprising to me after all this time. The trend was upward, but it was slow. That would be a general summary. About 20 miles from where we're sitting, I cowboyed in the 1960s. I was able to fish on a creek that had a lot of native trout in it. It has now been completely silted in by, I would say, the history of poorly managed grazing on that drainage. So how do you see the percentage of the commonness of what I will call poor land stewardship despite the new system? Common, uncommon, and why?
That's a really important question. Whenever you get into any activity, there's always good players and bad players. You have to remember that the resource, the grazing resource in the West, was pretty well trashed up till 1934. And you talked about BLM lands, but you also have to remember those are lands that no one wanted to homestead because they didn't have as good of soils, didn't have as good of water. So it takes them longer to recuperate. Economics is huge, and often you have swings in the economy, the livestock industry, and folks don't want to go broke, don't want to lose what they have, so that they exceed what they should over the short term. And that has caused or led sometimes to mismanagement of the resources that they're on, and there's no question that that's occurred.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're sitting on the Continental Divide with longtime rancher Jim Hagenbarth. Those are interesting observations. Now, as a citizen of the United States with a small share in ownership of our public lands, whether it's Forest Service or BLM, I would expect and hope that the agency, in the case of, let's say, a land manager, land a lessee that you describe, who's under financial pressure, feels the need to put too many livestock on an allotment, that you have some sort of policing or monitoring of that system to ensure it's done right. What's your sense for that? Are there failures? If so, why?
That's a tough question, but the truth of the matter is there is site-specific degradation, and usually it's addressed in the long term. You have to have a lessee that will participate with the agency, and you have to have an agency that has the expertise to address the problem. You also have to have the funding to fund necessary mitigation, maybe fence in the riparian area, maybe develop an upland water to address these situations. You also have possibly allotments that were designed and with a change maybe from sheep to cattle, they didn't fit the animal, and maybe the allotment's not appropriate for grazing a different class of livestock. So those are hard issues, and you're dealing with people's families, And you're dealing with an agency that's had a very difficult time because of budget and personnel changes to correct those kind of problems.
Let's discuss this now in relation to your family's experience with sheep. You said your great-grandfather, I think, might have been your grandfather, had 150,000 sheep grazed in this part of the world. During a major part of the 20th century, sheep grazing was extremely prominent in the livestock industry and in grazing private and public lands. I realize it's a big subject, but could you sketch out for us over the 20th century sort of the ebb and flow of sheep on the landscape?
Originally, most everyone in this country were sheepmen, and those cattlemen that say they've never been around sheep are fibbing, because sheep started everything in the West. You didn't need any infrastructure. You needed the animals and one herder and one person to take care of that herder or several herders. And you moved throughout the resource, up in the mountains in the summer, down in the desert in the winter. And these animals, if managed properly, provide a tremendous impact on the resource the day they're there. If they don't come back until a year later, that's ideal in regards to resource management and what the large ungulate herds did. And consequently, they're huge and probably the best grazing tool we have.
Let me just see if I understand you, because it's somewhat counterintuitive to those of us who are not experts in grazing. If I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying precisely because sheep have an intense effect on the landscape they graze, they can mimic the historic grazing patterns of wild ungulates over a more compressed and manageable time than other types of livestock. Do I understand you correctly?
That's right, Brian. And what's important is time. Disturbance over time, a short period of time, is very beneficial for biodiversity. Disturbance over a long period of time or the whole growing season is extremely destructive on the resource.
We recently did a show with Cooper Hibbard, who's about to take over management of that longtime family ranch, and we were discussing holistic range management. And if I got it correctly, that what you've just summarized seems to me to be the core principle of holistic range management, which is timing the grazing disturbance to stimulate plant growth, soil disturbance, etc., again, in a way that mimicked mobile, moving wild herds, as opposed to long-term static grazing, which in many places we associate with the livestock or the cattle industry. In general, do I have that correct?
That's right, Brian. It's important that vegetation on the landscape is what is important for the sustainability, long-term sustainability of the landscape and the natural systems. And grazing is part of that, and it's extremely important that we recognize that and graze in such a way that you promote that. And to do otherwise is counterproductive, not only for the resource, but for the livestock person's bottom line.
It's very interesting for me to hear you say that. If you'd asked me before, I would say my sense is in photographs of 19th, 20th century grazing and just sort of talk, I haven't researched it, my sense would be people's perception is sheep are hard on the land. Am I misinformed?
Just as with any tool, sheep are one of the tools that we can use to cause disturbance. It's a very effective tool. But if you don't use it correctly, it can be very destructive. But if you use it correctly and use time and don't allow them to be there very long, it's probably one of the best tools that we have to manage for disturbance necessary to keep the resource biodiverse. There's one other important point when you start talking about sheep, and because of what they graze, forbs and brushes and stuff like that, it doesn't take a lot of infrastructure, very few fences, and they can cover country that should be grazed, that can't be grazed by cattle without huge investments, and that's extremely important. They're an animal that we can use where other animals can't be used, and that's huge.
Let's talk about another flashpoint, I think, in terms of evolved social concerns. predator control, whether it's cattle or sheep, there's a history in the United States of government agencies at the urging of the livestock industry of controlling predators to reduce predation on livestock on public lands. I go back to the 70s and the 60s where there was the widespread use of poisoning, for example, and a lot of, from the data that I saw when I was on the California Fish and Game Commission, impact on non-target species, that by non-target species that weren't intended to be killed were killed by poison. And then there's the broader philosophical issue of, does it make sense to decimate or try to wipe out predators in the name of protecting livestock? What's your sense for that specifically in relation to the history of sheep?
Throughout history, Brian, there's always been a conflict between predators and food-producing animals throughout the world. And lots of different societies have handled it different ways. Left alone, the sheep industry in the West, of course, moved to the easiest way in which to control predators, and that was with poison. I didn't hear a coyote howl until I was 12 years old because of poison. In 1970, we lost poison, and now we've had to move to different ways in which to manage predation on our herds. If you are running a herd which is subject to predation, it's part of doing business. The amount of predation and ways to limit it is the problem, and it can certainly be solved with introduction of dogs to manage the herds, and that's been very, very effective. And not only against bear, black bear, grizzly bear, and wolves, it's made a big difference, and it's increased the sheepmen who are left ability to manage within the political and social environment in regards to predators.
I think that's a very interesting summary. I remember when the use of poisons was outlawed by the federal government, I think in part in response to conservationist lobbying. But you just said something that's sort of counterintuitive to me, that dogs around sheep, if I understand you, are able to control grizzly bears. It doesn't sound like... Tell me about it.
These bears that are out here that aren't habituated, you know, they're out here just grazing like everything else does, and they don't want to be harassed. There's a lot of food out here for them. They don't have to be killing the sheep. There's other things there. A lot of bears are omnivorous. So the dogs present a frustration to them, kind of a threat to them. The dogs aren't going to kill them. And in regards to the coyote, it's very interesting, and the wolf. Canines have, they respect each other's territories. So the dogs don't actually challenge them and chase them. But what they do is mark out territory, and an honest predator respects that territory. These dogs, a lot of them came from Europe, the Commodore, the Pyrenees, and they are raised with the sheep, and it's bred into them. And it's instinct to live with these sheep and mark their territory and to protect the sheep.
You're listening to Home Ground, and I'm Brian Kahn. We're sitting on the Continental Divide of Montana and Idaho with Jim Hagenbarth talking about livestock and sheep over time. I mentioned where we're sitting. I didn't mention that we are sitting in the territory monitored by part of the United States Sheep Experiment Station. Most of us wouldn't have heard of that, but sheep people know what it is. And there's a recent proposal put forward by the Department of Agriculture, the United States Department of Agriculture, to terminate its operations. Jim, is that a good idea, a bad idea, and why?
It's a bad idea because it shows that the Department of Agriculture and ARS do not recognize the value of ecological research on thousands of acres of ground that would be similar to the research that we need to understand to manage the thousands and millions of acres of public land in the United States.
When I think of sheep research, I would think of sheep research in terms of which breed is most productive and birth rates and stuff like that. I gather that's not what you're talking about here. What kind of research has been conducted by this station over what period of time?
Since from 1915 to 1922, the Sheep Experiment Station has put together about five different landscapes that have different qualities and represent different landscapes in the United States and also throughout the world. The research they're doing is on productive models in regards to managing livestock and vegetative manipulation on the research itself to mimic natural processes and how that impacts the resource and the tools that we use to manage that resource in the long term. They've been doing this for 100 years, and they have the data set and the land set that's been managed under that scenario for 100 years. If we lose that, we lose a data set that can never be replaced. And this information is huge as we try to understand how to manage a landscape as a working landscape and do it in a way that sustains the landscape itself as we should be required as a responsible individual as we manage these great big areas in the West.
When you say they managed various or studied various landscapes or varied landscapes, what are we talking about?
That's important because different landscapes need different management. And the landscapes vary from the top of the Continental Divide, which is looked at from as a corridor for wildlife to go from Yellowstone to Glacier. They're down on high mountain pastures. Then they're down on a semi-desert ground. It's about 13 inches of moisture. And then they go down to the desert in southeastern Idaho.
Research is a broad concept. Can you tell me specifically what kind of research? Give me an example of what they have done, what they do.
They have looked at a lot of different researches, but the one that's most pertinent to our operation into this area is how to manage the sagebrush ecosystem in Mountain Big Sage Country at over 13 inches of moisture using production, using grazing, using prescribed fire to enhance the sustainability of the sagebrush ecosystem. And it's extremely important in regards to the sagebrush issue that possibly might close down most uses in the West.
Prescribed fire, now that is like a curveball to me. Why are they studying prescribed fire in relation to grazing in this ecosystem and sage grouse?
Prescribed fire is just a tool that mimics natural fire. Sagebrush in this area is very productive and have good volcanic soils. So it really, after a fire, it takes 18.33 years to return to a climax. And so as you graze a resource, you're putting extra pressure on the forbs and the grasses, the sagebrush increases. So you use prescribed fire to bring it back to the norm and in the long run. And disturbance is the secret to biodiversity and enhancement of the sustainability, the ecological sustainability of the resource. It's extremely important.
It's interesting for me to hear you describe this, and that you have come back again and again to the use of the word disturbance. I think from a contemporary urban perspective, when we come out and look at this beautiful landscape, it looks undisturbed. It looks beautiful. And I think our inclination is to think that, therefore, disturbance is bad for this landscape. I'm hearing you say some kind of disturbances are beneficial. Am I misunderstanding you?
Brian, I don't think so. If you have a domestic lawn around your house and you never disturb it and you never mow it, it just grows up, turns brown, lays down, becomes decadent. And it's no different on the landscape. So disturbance is huge. It mixes the organic plant litter back into the soil. It is the most important thing in regards to the landscape. You have floods, you have fires, you have wind, you have snow, you have grazing. There's all lots of different disturbances. You have insects, you have moles and stuff that aerate the soil, and it's huge. Without disturbance, you'd have monocultures that would be truly unproductive.
Back to the research station, I read some materials that you provided. The Secretary of Agriculture has notified the appropriate congressional committee that they don't have the money over long-term, budgets are tight. What do you say to that?
Brian, I've been involved with the research people on the sheep station all my life, and those folks are objective. They know more about this resource than anyone else. When the Forest Service came up here and analyzed under an environmental assessment these lands, they found them to be some of the most productive and most pristine grazing lands in the tall four plant community in the United States. These folks understand the impacts on the resource from grazing, have cataloged it, and it's extremely important for all of us who use this resource that these ecologists, we understand what they're saying, and especially the federal government, who has millions of acres out here. There's no research more important than the research that helps us understand how we need to manage this landscape to keep it sustainable for ourselves and for everyone down the road, all our kids and all progeny. It's our responsibility to do that. And the federal government should support this, especially because of all the federal land they've decided to manage in the western states.
It seems to me this raises a fundamental question. We live, as I mentioned, in a more urbanized technological society, removed from the direct interface with the natural world, and I think many of us would look at some landscape like this and the wild, quote-unquote, wild landscapes and say, why don't we just leave it alone? Why don't we let nature manage it rather than try to have humans manage it? What would you say to that philosophical question or point of view?
What's important to remember is the people have been in the urban areas so long, they really don't understand their relationship with nature and with the environment. And truly, we are part of that environment. And she controls us, whether you know it or not. The food on your table comes from that environment, from the working landscape of that environment. So the better that we understand that environment, the better we can sustain our populations and the populations of the world as they grow exponentially in the future. So the better we understand the resource, and the better we manage it, the longer we'll be able to sustain the way we want to live. And do that in a way that enhances the sustainability of the natural world.
Jim Hagenbarth, I very much regret to say we're out of time. I want to thank you so much for being with us on Home Ground and for taking me up here to this incredibly beautiful landscape. And to our listeners, many thanks for being with us. We hope you'll join us next week. Home Ground is an independent production of Artemis Common Ground and does not necessarily reflect the views of this radio station. Post-production by Valtron Recording Studios. We welcome your ideas for new programs at www.homegroundradio.org. Home Ground is made possible by grants from the Liz Claiborne Art Ortenberg Foundation, Cinnabar Foundation, Humanities Montana, and the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication about issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans.